This is The Artist's Response with Elizabeth Stewart, and you're welcome to join us. Please stay tuned for a program produced by Richard Dugan and researched and presented by Elizabeth Stewart, who welcomes the great artists of our community. What follows is a conversation of an artist's experience about the artist's response to trying times, creativity, reinvention, recovery, and of course, flexibility, which is in fact the narrative of our present time.
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And this is, Richard and I generally like to do a reportage on the news of the art world. And this is a part of our reportage of the news in the art world. And this is news that's covering the spring of 2022. And I would like to start by saying that the information that I've garnered for this news broadcast, the news of the art world, is garnered from two separate publications. One is ArtNet News, which is an online publication, and the other one is Art Newspaper. And both have been around a long time, and both have their own dedicated reporters of the arts. If you are interested in learning more about the news of the art world that impacts the world in general because of the economic tenor, I recommend those two. But anyway, I want to start the show by telling you about a Catholic church in Brooklyn. Now, if you can imagine, this church was built in the late 19th century, and it's beautiful Gothic carved stone angels, etc. And in the center of the altar is a 6-7 foot tabernacle, which is round and it's solid gold, bejeweled, and it contains the Eucharist. And it is so valuable that a sliding metal door, which is also round, closes upon the tabernacle every night. However, on May 26, 2022, St. Augustine's in Brooklyn was robbed. And the thieves decided not to take the stuff that was easily robbable, but they decided to use a blowtorch and other mechanical machinery to cut that solid metal door away, to cut the stone walls, to behead the guardian angels. And they stole the security system and completely caved in the metal door around the tabernacle. They stole the entire tabernacle, which is almost impossible to conceive of because it's massive. It's like, how do you steal something solid gold the size of a coffin, for example? And the jury's still out. If you look at the news reports on this, you'll find that the Brooklyn police have put out an emergency tip line. They say that whoever did this must have had an inside connection with the church because the security system had a key on it that only a few people knew, and the thieves took the security system. So we are still looking for a massive, ornate, bejeweled gold tabernacle. We just hope that the thieves are not going to melt it down. Now, in New Mexico, I don't know if you've heard of this story, but in 2010, a gentleman named Forrest Fenn, who was an antique dealer and a treasure hunter, and a certain type of guy who collected Native American material and Western memorabilia, so kind of an intrepid guy, he decided to write a book in 2010. And he decided that he would announce in his book that he was going to fill an antique box, a coffer, quite large, with gold coins. And he put $2 million worth of gold coins in this coffer. And he hauled the coffer on a conveyance pulled by horses to a remote location in the Rocky Mountains. And he hid it. And at the end of his book, he gave a cryptogram that said something like, okay, the coordinates and this and that. It was this really difficult to decipher poem. But he said that whoever could decipher the cryptogram and find the coffer and dig it up could keep the $2 million in gold coins. Now, this started a tremendous search for the coffer. Lots of people had his book. Lots of people thought they could figure it out. And it took 10 years of searching. For 10 years, people came and went. They thought they might know the location. They didn't. But it was found in 2020, just a few months before the dealer, his name was Forrest Fenn, before he passed away, just a few months. And it was found by a young medical student, very, very young, in his early 30s, who figured out the coordinates based on the cryptogram in this book. So this life collection of this particular dealer's estate, and life collection is pretty important in this case because he died at 90. When he started collecting, he was collecting in the mountains, Rocky Mountains, and also mountains of Montana. And he was an explorer himself. So he started collecting arrowheads. And that was as he was a young boy. And that led to some friends helping him in some of the Native American tribes understand what he was collecting. He went on to collect vast, vast amounts of Native American materials. And this is going to be auctioned very soon, June 9th, 2022. Beadwork, rare beads and leather dolls from the Plains tribes, Sitting Bull's own pipe, which is going on the block for $600,000 to $800,000, a Sioux grizzly bear necklace valued at $60,000, extensive Pueblo pottery collection, and his own collection of historic vintage photos of past Native American warriors and chiefs. Now, we mentioned that he started this collection when he was a boy, and then he branched out into Western paintings. So oil paintings by very famous Western artists of the West. Now, if you're interested to know more about this collection, Hindman Auctions is running the sale. And the book that was written in which he describes his life as a collector and a treasure hunter, and you can look and see if you can figure out the cryptogram there. The book is called The Thrill of the Chase. And the gentleman who has found the gold coins is Jack Stueff. And Jack has not decided whether or not he's going to auction that as a work of art in itself. So the question would be, can he auction it for more than the value of the coins within, which total $2 million? Okay, so Richard, do you ever play Wordle?
No, can't say as I have.
Okay, well, Wordle is a big deal. And it's a game people play. And, you know, if you happen to look at your Google, most trending searches, it'll say Wordle word of the year or of the day. The National Gallery of Art premiered their own Wordle game. They're calling it Artle, A-R-T-L-E. It's an art historical version of Wordle. And because they've started this new game on the National Gallery of Art website, their traffic to the website has increased 40%. And it's formatted like Wordle. So anybody who's listening to me that plays Wordle, this is formatted like Wordle. Each user is shown a new series each day of four artworks by four famous artists. And they have four chances to guess the artist. Visitors from every nation are now playing Artle on our National Gallery of Art website. And the test of the marketing department for the museum was how to market the game so as not to lose everybody, because not everybody knows every artist and how they and their works, for example. And by the way, if you do play Wordle, the history of Wordle is interesting. It was invented by Josh Wardle for his partner. And it became so popular, became so viral so quickly that the New York Times bought it for seven figures. In a really interesting twist, the National Gallery of Art out of Washington, D.C. is marketing Artle, which is very like Wordle, except it's all imagery. they're marketing it to students who want to earn extra credit in their art history courses. Now, does anyone know the band Twisted Sister?
I've not listened to them, but I'm familiar with the name of the group.
Are you, Richard, you know Twisted Sister?
I've heard of the group, and I can honestly say of the four sisters that I have, none of them are twisted.
Okay. Well, this is a heavy metal, a big hair group. And one of the leaders of the group is named Dee Snider. And Dee Snider figures very strongly into the current history of the Ukrainian-Russian war. And I'll tell you why when we come back from the break. You'll be amazed at this story and the legalities involved. And I don't know if you can guess it, but I'll give you a clue. It deals with the song called We're Not Going to Take It. I'll tell you more when we get back from the break. This is Elizabeth Stewart, and of course, Richard's behind the board, and we are telling you about the springtime 2022 news of the art world. And this particular story is an amazing story about the creative mind at work. So Dee Snider of Twisted Sister approved of a song that he wrote called We're Not Gonna Take It for use as the official anthem of the Ukrainian resistance. We're not gonna take it. Hell, we ain't gonna take it. Oh, we're not gonna take it anymore. You might say, well, how's that work? Because basically he gave them the rights to use the song. But let's say, like Chris Christie used Bruce Springsteen's song, he didn't have Bruce's permission. He didn't own the rights to the song. Christie didn't. What if Snider had not given the rights to the song to be used? And what if, for example, some of the tanks that are now blasting the song from speakers there in Ukraine, in Kiev, what if they were blasting the song and Dee Snider said, you can't do that. I own the song. Well, he gave them the song, so that wasn't the case. But what's happening in this world, in this space, is that many song catalogs have lately been purchased by investment groups. And I give you some example. Neil Diamond's portfolio, you could say catalog of songs, and Sting's catalog of songs sold to investors groups, both of them each catching nine figures. Now, let's say that the speaker is playing the song on a tank in Kiev and Dee Snider didn't authorize this and no money had changed hands. Could Dee Snider sue? Well, probably not, because no money has changed hands. But there's so much interesting copyright law about fine art used in this way, and songs and NFTs and memes and all this. If you play a song at a political rally, and if that song has performance rights, an artist can sue the venue. They can sue the hotel, for example. And I give you the example again, Chris Christie and Bruce Springsteen, where, you know, Springsteen said, you can't use my song, Mr. Christie. Okay. In another interesting story, the former director of the Louvre is under investigation. This is a gentleman named Jean-Luc Martinez, and he's charged with money laundering. Okay. He has been claimed or alleged to have ties with an antiquities trafficking ring. Now, he was head of the Louvre from 2013 to 2022. He has stepped down since. But this involves objects smuggled out of Egypt and purchased by the Louvre before he left. Now, the head of the Egyptian department at the Louvre and the Louvre Abu Dhabi have published an important paper on the historic importance of these objects. Now, you know, the French are so great. So the French satirical newspaper reported that this was all a big farce. And Martinez was turning a blind eye to the false certificates of origins that he had purchased along with these five pieces of European antiquities. By the way, what are we talking about here? We're talking about 50 million euros, a lot of money. One particular piece really caught the interest of the Egyptian government. It's a pink granite stele inscribed with a certain name, which is on display at the Louvre as a recent acquisition, Abu Dhabi. What is that name on the stele? It's Tutankhamun. Okay. In connection with this particular allegation, a Paris dealer and a German dealer who may have produced false documents to launder these objects sold to the Louvre also have been accused of hundreds of Near and Middle Eastern antiquities in similar positions. So the Paris dealer sold a gold sarcophagus of an Egyptian mummy for $3.5 million to the Met in New York a while back. Well, this was brought to the attention of the Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, seized and repatriated to Egypt in 2017. Also in New York City, the French art investigators are currently flying to Manhattan's District Attorney's Antiquities Trafficking Division, and they're investigating a smuggling ring that's been active since 2013. So what do you think Martinez is doing now? He stepped down as director of the Louvre. Well, he's Emmanuel Macron's ambassador on restitution of fine art now. I mean, the art world is nuts. The art world is crazy as the real world, basically. Richard, here's okay. I'm going to give you a question. The top cities for art in the United States. What do you think the top cities are? And let's see, how many are them? So you, let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, there's 5 top cities for the arts. And I'll tell you what the categories are. What top cities in the United States exhibit the most work at art institutions and galleries, and what cities exhibit emerging artists' work, and what cities encourage the emerging artists to continually do new work? So that's the those are the criteria. So name me the top U.S. 5 cities for art in the United States.
All right, I'm going to start with New York.
Yes.
That's Los
number
Angeles.
One. What's number two?
Los Angeles, Chicago.
Yes. No, you missed one. Los Angeles is 2. What's 3?
Chicago.
Nope. Chicago's 4, but what's 3? You should see Richard's face, too.
I'm taking a shot. I'm just going to take a shot. Washington, D.C. I know it's not a state, but...
No. San Francisco.
San Francisco. Oh.
So it's New York 1, L.A. 2, San Francisco 3, Chicago 4. What's number 5?
I'm going to go with my gut. Phoenix. Phoenix, Arizona.
No, it's not Phoenix. No. No, in fact, that's like number 149th.
Okay.
It's Miami.
Miami, really?
Yeah. So the top cities again, and you might say, well, who makes this reportage? I mean, who put this together? The top cities: New York, L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, and Miami. The predication is, the criteria is, who exhibits most work, who has the most active art institutions, museums, galleries, you know, white cube spaces, et cetera, et cetera. Who shows the most work by 20th century artists and 21st century artists who are producing work right now, and what cities encourage the artists to keep creating and keep showing New York, LA, San Francisco, Chicago, and Miami. New York, because it's New York. LA has the fewest museums of all those five we're talking about, but they have a really active gallery scene. San Francisco has the museums and the gallery scenes. Chicago, because there's been so many interesting new art fairs in Chicago, and of course the great institutions of art there. You know, I was born and raised in Chicago, and you know, that museum, the Art Institute in Chicago, is the, I think, the finest. I love it. And then Miami, because a while back, I think it was in the early 2000s, Art Basel came to Miami. That was a big show out of Switzerland, and they kind of moved to Miami. And Art Basel's a huge deal. I've been a number of times, and it's a huge deal. And it spawned all kinds of little shows and big shows. So when Art Basel comes, the whole city is involved. And it's an amazing thing to see. But who has done these metrics? Who has determined that these are the cities? Well, the art world pays a lot of attention to a bank report called the USB Bank Report that's authored by economist Claire McAndrew. And I've known of McAndrew's work for a long time because she does every year an economic report on the art market. And she's a great economist that just focuses on art in the economy of art. And she writes a report. Now, this year she wrote that report, but she also wrote a report on the U.S. cities that are the biggest players in the global art market. So can we talk about the global art market first? So the global art market, which her report is about the entire market of the world. But the U.S., she concluded, accounts for half of all world art sales last year. Okay, what, Richard, how much do you think it's in the bees? What do you think is half of all the world's art sales? What figure comes to mind?
I'm going to throw out, I was going to say 100 billion. I'm going to say 300 billion.
Okay, so 100 billion is pretty close to the whole total.
Wow.
The U.S. accounts for about half. And, you know, that's pretty vast when you consider that, you know, London's pretty active, Hong Kong, Paris, you know, there's a big art market out there, but the U.S. accounts for half. It's very interesting when we sit here and we say, my God, look at the economy, look at how many people are out of work, blah, 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 blah. But the U.S. accounts for half of all sales of all art in the global economy. That just blew me away. And so, this is the global art market, and the main players in the U.S. global art market that account for half of the world's art sales are 1, New York, 2, L.A., 3, San Francisco, 4, Chicago, and 5, Miami. Isn't that amazing?
I would have another interesting question, but this is probably a sidebar to all of the statistics that you're throwing out. Who among the artists featured at these, let's just say these top five locations, who garners not just the most interest, but the most dollars for their art, living and then dead and then combined?
Well, I can answer that question. I'm going to answer that in one of our next stories, but there's an artist that's really very important right now who's dead, but actually he died very young, is Basquiat. And we're going to talk a little bit about his work. What we're talking here is it's some of the main players in the contemporary art market. They're either 20th century or 21st century. I'm going to say, if you had to ask me, who are the big names that people spend millions and millions and millions of dollars for, you know, the record holders recently, Basquiat, Warhol, Lichtenstein, these are some, some names that come to mind right away. And then as far as dead artists, from the early 20th century, you've got, Matisse is always a huge player. You've got work by not the realists, but work by a kind of the pre-moderns and modern folks entering the art scene right at the beginning of the 20th century. They're always major, you know, Picasso, for example. They're always major. You know, Picasso can easily sell a work by his, an original oil can be in the 100 million range. You know, we're talking a lot of money here. So when we get back from the break, I'm going to tell you about a story about one of these artists that I just mentioned to you, Basquiat. Now, this is about a dealer. Just, can you imagine this? About a dealer who liked to shop online, you know, used eBay. He used First Dibs. He used, what else did he use? He used the online platforms. And he shopped just like we all shop, you know, and we look and we say, oh, that looks like a bargain on eBay. And he bought something on eBay that he purchased by, he alleged it was by this artist Basquiat. He bought it for under $500. And, you know, people started to wonder about this guy because he was doing this a lot. He was finding things on eBay, on, you know, these online sites, and he was selling them in his gallery in Palm Beach, Florida. Well, one day, okay, this involves the FBI agent walking into his gallery. So I'll hold that thought so I can tell you about it, Rich, when we get back from the break. The minute the FBI agent walked into the gallery and saw a piece that a dealer had purchased for under $500, I'm going to ask you what you think the sticker price was on that when we get back from the break. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. And, you know, every month or so, I like to look at the art world newspapers and see what's happening in the art world and the hair-raising, cringeworthy stories that come out of the art world. And Richard and I were just reviewing some of the latest stories from the spring of 2022. The theft of a 2-ton solid gold tabernacle that was behind a solid steel wall at St. Augustine's in Brooklyn. The theft right through the solid metal, the hauling out of a solid gold basilica. The police do not have a clue. This happened on May 26, very recently, and there's still, if you go to the website, there's a phone number, tip line. So if you see someone walking down the street with a solid gold, ruby, diamond, sapphire tabernacle filled with angels and Gothic tracery, if you see them walking down the street in New York, you know who to call, and that will be the Brooklyn Police, because they haven't got a clue who did it or how it happened. That was our first story. Our second story was the New Mexico art and antiques dealer who in 2010 hid $2 million gold coins in a box, secreted them in a remote place in the Rocky Mountain, published a book that gave some clue as to where it was. It took many people 10 years to find it. It has recently been found, and this gentleman's collection outside of the gold coins, he has an amazing collection of Native American material. His family is auctioning off everything. And that's happening this month at Hinman Auctions. The jury is out whether or not the finder of the gold coins is going to keep the coins or if he's going to auction them off and actually make more than $2 million because of the notoriety of this chest. Our third story was Wordle, that Wordle, the game has been transmutated, and there's a version of it by the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. called Artle. And if you like the history of art, take a look at it. It's super interesting. You can challenge yourself to see if you can, you know, say, okay, there's a Renoir, there's a Matisse, there's a Cassatt, there's a Manet. You can look at it, see those, you'll see it on the cards there, and you can win just like you can in Wordle. Say our other story was about Twisted Sister. Now, how did they get into the news? Twisted Sister, the group, Dee Snider of Twisted Sister just recently gave the rights to his song, We're Not Going to Take It, to the Ukrainian resistance. And all the copyright issues involved around that, it's so interesting. But, you know, Dee Snider himself has been tweeting why he did this, and he's so supportive of the Ukrainian resistance. It's pretty interesting to see. You know, he's not a spring chicken anymore, the guy. And he certainly doesn't have the big hair and the, you know, fantastic chest that he once has. I'll give you a clue, but you can take a look. A long-lost Titian was recovered after a theft in 2004 by Italian police in a lowly restoration studio, you know, an art restorer studio. That's an amazing thing. It's a big Titian was discovered. And then the former director of the Louvre, Jean-Luc Martinez, is under investigation by a lot of different art squads for buying 50 million euros worth of Egyptian antiquities. Along with him, are being investigated two very, shall we say, shady dealers, one of which sold a sarcophagus to the Metropolitan Museum that the Manhattan District Attorney has confiscated. And then we talked, Richard and I, about the art world and the five cities that have the biggest clout in the art world in the United States, namely New York, LA, San Francisco, Chicago, and Miami. Now we get to the story of the lifetime here. A dealer in Palm Beach, Florida, is charged as very recently with wire fraud, mail fraud, money laundering for selling a fake Basquiat. Not only did he sell a fake Basquiat, well, allegedly fake, but he sold Warhols, Lichtensteins, Banksys, Matisses, Hundertwassers, and a Keith Haring. These are all reproductions of artworks stamped with seals of authenticity. Now, how did that happen? I mentioned to Richard that he liked to shop online. So he looked at eBay, he looked at iBid, iGavel, FirstDibs, et cetera. And he found what he thought was an interesting looking Basquiat. I think it was in the $400 to $500 range. Then he made up a authentication that Basquiat's dad, who he had gotten in touch with, had authenticated it. Now, it was on the gallery wall, and the FBI had thought, well, geez, this is kind of interesting. This guy has had a lot of complaints from Palm Beach collectors that, you know, he's been selling things that later are found out not to be authentic. So guy dressed up like a Palm Beach collector, and I don't know what they look like in Palm Beach, but I bet you they were pretty slick looking. And he comes in as the FBI, he's undercover. And this just happened a couple of days ago. It comes into the gallery in Palm Beach, Florida. And he says, oh, I like that Basquiat. You know, can you tell me more about it? And the dealer says, well, you know, it's authenticated by Basquiat's father, et cetera. Comes from a really reputable collector. I mean, this is I think he bought it on eBay or iBid or something. I mean, not a reputable collector. And I'm asking $12 million. You're asking $12 million. You spent $400 and you're asking $12 million. Now, interestingly enough, the FBI agent knew about this tremendous markup. Anyway, the guy's in trouble now. And so the same dealer bought a Lichtenstein print from Live Auctioneers for $485. He sold it to a collector who was not an FBI agent, much to his luck. He sold it to a collector for $25,000. Nice markup, huh? Yes. And then the artist Red Catalog Raisiné. So Liechtenstein's Catalog Raisiné. By the way, Catalog Raisiné is the book that you look at that's usually written about almost every artist. So you can see, well, this print or this screen print or lithograph or painting, it should be this. It should have this. The signature should be here. There's this many prints made. There's this many editions, etc. It gives the whole breakdown of what the artist oeuvre is. Well, this Catalog Raisiné said that this particular Liechtenstein print should be in totally different colors. So the dealer was buying a nice reproduction on live auctioneers and making a fake certificate of authenticity and making a markup of $24,500. Not a bad day, huh, Richard?
Not bad. I wish I could do that. But why couldn't the guy just chalk it up to inflation? I mean, come on. We're in a whole economic thing here. Does inflation really... when we hear about this on the news, it doesn't really affect the art world, does it? I mean, art's going to go for what it's going to go for.
It does. In fact, it does affect it. It affects it in a really interesting way because actually the value of art increases. Is the supposition because those people that can afford to buy art are using art as a hedge against inflation.
I see.
Yeah, and it kind of falls along the lines, you know, gold, silver, commodities, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, I want to ask you, so now the dealer who sold a $400 Basquiat to an FBI agent for $12 million, what do you think the charges for such fraud are? What do you think the federal charges are for such things?
I'd give him 10 years and a job as a government economist.
Okay, there's four charges because he sold four pieces but each charge is 20 years. And there's a fine, and it always makes me just laugh to death because, you know, it's 20 years per charge times four, 80 years. And then the fine is like $250,000. Okay, which would you rather do? I mean, you don't get a choice, of course. But it always seems to me that these fines are not proportionate to 80 years of your life in prison. But anyway, that's just me.
No, well, yeah, exactly. I'd believe it or not, I know it sounds bizarre. I'd take the 80 years because I'd get free room and board.
Yeah. It depends the stage where you are in life.
It's that like, is well, true. If I was in my 90s, I'd take the 80 years.
Yeah, right. Well, it depends on, you know, I just cannot stand my roommate. I got to get out of here. You know, this is looking better and better every minute. I'm going to forge a couple Basquiats and a couple Liechtensteins and, you know, maybe, well, heck, get rid of my roommate in this way. Who knows? Okay, another story here. I love looking at the website for the FBI art crime team. It's very interesting. I love that kind of mystique. And I love looking into what, you know, the police types think of the art world. It's such a confluence of two types of people. It's just really interesting to me. The FBI art crime team is now investigating. Oh, this is a great one. They're investigating 25 works that are hanging in the museum as Basquiats at the Orlando Museum of Art. Now, where did they come from? Where did those 25 works come from?
That's a good question.
Have you watched the show Storage Wars?
Yeah, where they go in, they break the locks off of the storage units, and you go in there and you bid on it before they break it open.
Okay,
and
these
you may get
works
a bunch of cardboard
art,
boxes,
you know,
or
millions and millions and millions of dollars each.
Wow! Millions,
and they discovered the works of art in a storage locker.
Wow!
Now, what are the chances? And our final story, I know we have to go, but our final story is an entire Mayan city, which was once inhabited by 4,000 people from 600 to 900 AD, was discovered as construction was being I guess ground was being broken in an area in Mexico, Merida, Mexico. This entire city that housed 4,000 people for a total of 300 years has been recently discovered. How do you lose an entire city? We lost an entire city for over 1,500 years. I mean, how did that happen? They recently discovered this.
Well, probably the same way
that we discovered that the Basquiat's in the storage locker.
Some of these dictators and oligarchs lost, with air quotes, certain pieces of art.
Yeah, it is.
As we talked about in the previous program.
Yeah. Very interesting. Hey, Richard, do you have any question for me before we go?
Well, yeah, I do. I'm just curious as to what has been for you the most, and again, I know you're an appraiser, and I don't think that you work off of commissions based upon the appraisal. Yours is a fee or what have you.
That's
I'm curious,
right.
What has been the most highest priced item that you have found and appraised over the years?
I have two. Number one, when I was first starting out in business, I've been doing this 30 years, but when I first started out in business, somebody brought me a screen, an Asian screen that had scrolls that had been, affixed to the screen. And it really foxed me. It was Korean. I didn't know what it was. And I declined the job because I didn't understand it. And I let the job go to a senior appraiser. I was a trainee at the time. And anyway, I always was interested, what was that piece? And a number of years later, I had photos of it. A number of years later, I see it on the cover of the Metropolitan Museum of Art Bulletin for new acquisitions. It's like, $50 million, $60 million, that's a lot of money. Anyway, and the other thing was, I have a theory that the best things I've ever seen, the best works of art and antiques and everything else that I've ever seen are in some of the smallest places. So I'll give you an example. When somebody decides that they are going to save their money and they're going to move and inhabit a mobile home, they get rid of everything except what really speaks to them, because they don't have the room. And I found it N.C. Wyeth, the Andrew Wyeths, the famous Brandywine painting family. I was appraising for the woman. She wanted to donate it to her alma mater. And she said, I have a Wyeth and I'm in this, trailer park in Santa Maria. And I'm thinking, a Wyeth in a trailer park in Santa Maria I almost said no, it couldn't happen. But I know that that's probably extremely likely, because if you get rid of everything but the Wyeth, you've got rid of the junk and kept the gold, basically. And that painting, that was, I don't know how many millions, and things that are really strange that people, they speak to the folks, they speak to the owners, and the owners don't know sometimes what to do with them. So they hide them. They think, I don't know what this is, so I'm going to hide it in back of the piano. We once found a really famous artist hidden in back of someone's piano, just the canvas, no frame, just hidden in back of a piano because, it's too much to think about that maybe it could be something, or I don't really want to think about it because maybe someone will steal it if it is something. So it's almost counterintuitive. The best stuff is not generally known. It's generally the last thing somebody shows you as you're leaving. They're like, this couldn't be worth anything. And then they show you something and it's like, Yeah, you just pave your kid's education right there. I mean, you know, that's nature of the business. Anyway, Richard, thank you for that question.
You're very welcome, and I will look forward to our future monthly conversations regarding the art world. I would love to hear some of the stories of art that was either A, trying to be preserved and was and ended up being destroyed, or B, was being moved from one gallery to the next and was destroyed. This probably would apply more to sculptures than anything else.
I tell you, this is that what's so interesting about that in anybody's personal home, the times when things are damaged, when people are trying to improve them.
All right. Well, that'll be a wrap for us here. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Hi. Bye-bye.